perks, including a forthcoming town hall, which I will tell you more about next week. See you on the bonus show, or otherwise, sadly, if you're not a member, we'll have to wait until tomorrow.
WRCT in sound from way out.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you... For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Tragedy is not humanitarian, it is political. I'm therefore appealing for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire to allow for progress in serious political negotiations aiming at reaching a peace agreement based on the principles of the United Nations Charter.
As UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres calls for a humanitarian ceasefire in Ukraine, negotiators from Russia and Ukraine are holding peace talks in Turkey. We'll go to Ukraine to speak with a Guardian reporter who just left the bombed-out city of Kharkiv. Then, as a federal judge says Donald Trump and his lawyer likely committed multiple felonies in their bid to block Joe Biden's election victory, we'll also look at a new Frontline ProPublica documentary, Plot to Overturn the Election.
In the coming weeks, I was focused on the violence in the streets. I didn't realize that something far more consequential was happening in the hotel suites around me. A plot to undermine and overturn the election.
Plus, calls are growing for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas to be impeached after the release of text messages showing his wife, Ginny Thomas, pushing Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, to overturn the election. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Negotiators from Ukraine and Russia have opened their first direct peace talks in more than 2 weeks. Ahead of today's negotiations in Istanbul, Turkey, President Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine is unwilling to compromise on its sovereignty and territorial integrity, but is open to discussing neutrality and a prohibition on Ukraine joining NATO. On Monday, The Wall Street Journal and the investigative news site Bellingcat reported the Russian billionaire Roman Abramovich and Ukrainian peace negotiators suffered symptoms of suspected poisoning after a meeting in Kyiv earlier in March. The symptoms reportedly included red eyes and peeling skin on their faces. The Wall Street Journal cited unnamed officials who suspected the negotiators were poisoned by hardliners in Moscow seeking to sabotage peace talks, but others have expressed skepticism. The BBC reports a senior Ukrainian official said members of the Ukrainian delegation were fine and that one of them had called reports of poisoning false. Roman Abramovich is in Istanbul today as part of the latest round of peace talks. Ahead of the negotiations, Ukraine's foreign minister warned his delegation to be cautious.
I advise anyone going for negotiations with the Russian Federation not to eat or drink anything, and preferably avoid touching any surface.
Ukraine's military says it has recaptured several towns from Russian forces, including Irpin, a strategic suburb outside the capital Kyiv. Meanwhile, the mayor of Mariupol said nearly 5,000 residents, including 210 children, have died in Russia's assault on the besieged city, which was home to nearly 500,000 people before Russia's invasion. On Monday, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for an immediate ceasefire.
A cessation of hostilities will allow essential humanitarian aid to be delivered and enable civilians to move around safely. It will save lives, prevent suffering, and protect civilians.
In Russia, the prominent independent newspaper, Novaya Gazeta, said Monday it's halting operations until the war in Ukraine is ended, after the paper's editors received a second warning from a Russian state censor. Last year, the paper's editor-in-chief, Dmitry Muratov, won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work reporting in the face of government repression and censorship. Muratov recently put his Nobel Medal up for auction, with proceeds of its sale set to support Ukrainian refugees. Also on Monday, the Kremlin ordered Russian media outlets not to publish a rare interview with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky by independent Russian journalists, including Dmitry Muratov. It's believed at least 150 journalists have left Russia since the start of the Ukraine invasion last month. President Biden said Monday he's expressing his moral outrage and not official U.S. policy when he suggested last weekend that Vladimir Putin should be removed as president of Russia. Biden's off-the-cuff remark during a visit to Poland on Saturday threatened a rupture in diplomatic ties between the U.S. and Russia.
I want to make it clear, I wasn't then, nor am I now, articulating a policy change. I was expressing the moral outrage that I feel, and I make no apologies for it.
Personal feelings, sir.
My personal feelings.
On Monday, the Pentagon said it's sending six Navy attack planes and 240 more troops to Germany to bolster NATO's military buildup during the war in Ukraine. The White House has sent Congress a $5.8 trillion budget request that would raise taxes on billionaires and corporations while massively boosting funding for the Pentagon and the police. Biden's budget proposal does not include items from his Build Back Better plan, which failed to pass the narrowly divided Senate over objections from conservative Democrats Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. The budget proposes more than $30 billion in grants to state and local police departments. It would also boost military spending by about 10% to a record-shattering $813 billion, eclipsing even former President Trump's Pentagon budget requests. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders responded in a statement, quote, "At a time when we're spending more on the military than the next 11 countries combined, no, we do not need a massive increase in the defense budget," Sanders said. A federal judge ruled Monday that former President Trump and his lawyer likely committed multiple felonies in their bid to block certification of Joe Biden's Electoral College victory in the 2020 election. In a 44-page ruling, U.S. District Court Judge David Carter ordered Trump legal advisor John Eastman to turn over hundreds of emails to the House committee investigating the January 6 attack on the Capitol. Judge Carter determined Trump and Eastman launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election that was unprecedented in U.S. history, calling it a, quote, coup in search of a legal theory, unquote. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting records released to the January 6 Select Committee show a gap of more than 7 hours in President Trump's phone logs as the Capitol was being assaulted. The Post reports the committee is investigating whether Trump communicated that day through back channels, phones of aides, or personal disposable phones known as burner phones. Also on Monday, the House January 6 committee voted unanimously to recommend criminal contempt of Congress charges against former White House aides Peter Navarro and Dan Scavino after they became the latest former Trump administration officials to refuse to cooperate with congressional subpoenas. In Afghanistan, the Taliban has banned several international media outlets, including Voice of America, the BBC, and Germany's Deutsche Welle. This comes after dozens of women, students, and teachers held a peaceful protest in front of Afghanistan's education ministry in Kabul over the weekend in response to the Taliban's order to shut down secondary schools for girls. This is a school teacher.
The Taliban are scared of an educated girl. When a girl is educated, a family will be educated. And when a family is educated, a nation will be educated. And finally, an educated nation will never, ever nourish the motives of terrorists.
The move prompted U.S. officials to cancel talks with Taliban leaders in Doha Friday to address key economic issues impacting Afghanistan. In India, hundreds of thousands of workers have gone on strike to protest Prime Minister Narendra Modi's neoliberal economic policies. A two-day shutdown began Monday, called on by dozens of labor unions from the private and public sector. Government workers, coal and copper miners, steel, oil and health workers are among those who've joined the strike as anger mounts over mass unemployment, rising food and fuel prices, worsening poverty and lack of access to health care and education. In Spain, hundreds of protesters gathered outside the Foreign Affairs Ministry in Madrid Saturday to protest the Spanish government's recent announcement it no longer supports self-determination for the Moroccan-occupied Western Sahara.
All Sahrawis in Spain have come here to demonstrate against the decision taken by Pedro Sanchez, which is once again betraying the Sahara. We feel betrayed because he said that he'd give sovereignty over the Sahrawi territory to the Moroccans, and we do not feel equal to them. We are Sahrawi, and we are the ones who decide our rights.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Morocco Monday, where he's meeting with the kingdom's foreign minister. In Mexico, 20 people were killed Sunday when gunmen opened fire on a crowd watching a cockfight in a small town in the western state of Michoacán. Police said they found more than 130-caliber shell casings at the crime scene. Mexico's military has joined the search for the killers, but so far no arrests have been made. Last year, Mexico filed a lawsuit in a U.S. federal court seeking to hold 10 U.S.-based gun makers accountable for Mexico's epidemic of gun violence. The complaint says more than 500,000 U.S.-made guns are smuggled to Mexico each year. Meanwhile, a new independent report into the 2014 disappearance of the 43 Ayotzinapa students says Mexico's Navy and Army officials had been surveilling the students and knew they were going to be kidnapped. The report also found officials hid evidence that could have helped locate the students. This is a member of the independent panel.
It was known by the authorities in Iguala, but also by authorities at the national level, what was happening at the time of the detention and subsequent disappearance of the students.
Back in the United States, Academy Award-winning actor Will Smith has issued an apology for slapping presenter Chris Rock at the Academy Awards Sunday on the stage after Rock joked about Smith's wife, Jada Pinkett Smith, being bald. Pinkett Smith suffers from alopecia. In an Instagram post, Smith said his reaction was, quote, unacceptable and inexcusable. Smith continued, quote, jokes at my expense are a part of the job, but a joke about Jada's medical condition was too much for me to bear, and I reacted emotionally. I'm embarrassed, and my actions were not indicative of the man who I want to be. There's no place for violence in a world of love and kindness, he wrote. The Academy on Monday condemned Smith's actions and launched an inquiry into what happened. And in Florida, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis Monday signed a bill that prohibits school discussions of sexuality and gender identity with students in kindergarten through third grade. DeSantis signed the bill, known by critics as Don't Say Gay, despite widespread condemnation from teachers, students, and the LGBTQ plus rights advocates who say the law will severely impact the mental health of children.
I don't care what corporate media outlets say. I don't care what Hollywood says. I don't care what big corporations say. Here I stand. I'm not backing down.
In a statement, the group Equality Florida said, quote, DeSantis has damaged our state's reputation as a welcoming and inclusive place for all families. This law will not stand. We will work to see it removed either by the courts as unconstitutional or repealed by the legislature, unquote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, the January 6th committee investigating the deadly attack on the Capitol is reportedly deciding whether to interview Ginni Thomas, the Republican activist who's also the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, about her efforts to overturn Donald Trump's 2020 election loss. The move comes after her texts with Trump's then chief of staff, Mark Meadows, in the weeks following the election were made public last week in a Washington Post CBS expose. In a series of 29 texts text messages to Meadows. Ginny Thomas urges him to take action to prevent a Biden victory, citing conspiracy theories about a stolen election popularized by the far-right QAnon movement. On November 10th, after news outlets declared Joe Biden the winner, Ginny Thomas wrote to Meadows, "Help this great president stand firm, Mark. You are the leader with him who is standing for America's constitutional governance at the precipice. The majority knows Biden and the left is attempting the greatest heist of our history," she texted. Just months ago, in January, the Supreme Court denied a request by Trump to block the release of White House documents around January 6. In the 8-1 ruling, only one justice dissented, Clarence Thomas, Ginny's husband. Calls are growing for Justice Thomas to be impeached after the release of the text messages. This comes as Justice Thomas participated remotely Monday in arguments at the Supreme Court after he was hospitalized for nearly a week with an unspecified infection. For more, we're joined by Ian Millhiser, senior correspondent at Vox, who's long followed Justice Thomas. His new piece out today is headlined, "Clarence Thomas's long fight against fair and democratic elections, like wife, like husband." He's the author of two books on the High Court, The Agenda, How a Republican Supreme Court's Reshaping America, and Injustices, The Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Ian, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can talk about the significance of what has been discovered about Ginny Thomas's texts and the connection to her husband and the rules in the Supreme Court around partners ruling in cases that involve, that may possibly involve their spouses.
Right. So what we know at this point is we know that Ginny Thomas was very much a cheerleader and a cheerleader at the highest levels. I mean, she was texting the White House chief of staff about, you know, cheering on Trump's efforts to overturn the election. We don't know yet if she was a co-conspirator. You know, was she in the room with people like John Eastman trying to plot the strategy to actually overturn the election? And the extent of her role could be revealed by various documents and various interviews that the January 6th committee is conducting. You know, you mentioned in the intro that the committee sought records from the White House. Justice Thomas tried to block their access to these records. And, you know, we don't yet know what's in those records. We don't know if they incriminate Ginny Thomas. We don't know if they reveal her to be a co-conspirator. Or we don't know if her name isn't mentioned at all. So if Clarence Thomas knew that his wife was potentially implicated in this scandal, I think he should have recused himself from that case, and he should recuse himself from any future cases related to this investigation, because, you know, when you're a judge, you can't sit on a case where your wife has an interest.
What are the conflict of interest requirements for justices of the Supreme Court? And there has been an attempt in Congress to tighten that, but Chief Justice Roberts has warned against Congress attempting to control an equal branch of government, in effect.
Yeah, so there's really two questions there. I mean, there is a statute that lays out certain obligations. You know, a judge shouldn't sit on a case where their impartiality can reasonably be questioned, and so on and so forth. The issue is that there's no enforceable ethics rules against the Supreme Court of the United States. So there's a statute which tells them what they're supposed to do. And the justices have said for a really long time, oh, yeah, we'll, you know, we are very, very careful about complying with ethics and so on and so forth. But ultimately, it's up to each individual justice. And I mean, this is the overarching problem we're having with the Supreme Court right now, is when this body gets out of line, when it gets overly partisan, when it starts ignoring the law, there really isn't a good method to rein in a rogue Supreme Court. I mean, there's impeachment, but impeachment takes 67 votes. We couldn't even successfully impeach Donald Trump after Donald Trump, you know, cheered on an attack on the Capitol. So I am pessimistic that anything is going to happen to Justice Thomas. But again, like, if his wife has an interest in a case, that is the classic case of where you need to recuse. You can't sit on a case that you have an interest in, and you can't sit on a case where your family, your immediate family members have a direct interest.
And Justice Ian Milhein,
I've been promoted, great.
Isn't it true that in this case, where Clarence Thomas was the only dissenter, he did not want to obligate Donald Trump to send over these documents. That's where the emails were discovered of his wife. So, I mean, there is a suggestion that he wanted to cover that up.
So my understanding is that the text messages that we know about between Ginni Thomas and Mark Meadows came from a different tranche. I believe that actually Mark Meadows voluntarily turned them over to the committee. The documents that the committee sought from the Trump White House, they were in the National Archives. Trump sued to try to block them, and I don't believe we know what's in those documents yet. Now, I'm sure the January 6th committee will get around to telling us very soon. But the question here is really, what did Clarence Thomas know and when did he know it? You know, when did Clarence Thomas know that his wife was potentially implicated in the January 6th attack? And if he knew that, then he obviously can't sit on a case involving an investigation into the January 6th attack.
And could you talk in general about Justice Thomas's record when his dissent in this case is not necessarily out of the ordinary for how he has dealt with cases in the past.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, if I didn't know about Ginni Thomas's involvement, I still wouldn't be surprised by the vote that Clarence Thomas cast in that one case, because he's consistently been a strong opponent of voting rights laws. You know, he is, you know, the Roberts Court has been awful to the Voting Rights Act. He's wanted to go much further. He is a supporter of a doctrine that would essentially allow state legislatures to ignore their state constitutions when passing election laws. He is a huge opponent of freedom of the press. He wants to overturn a case called New York Times v. Sullivan that protects reporters from malicious libel suits that seek to bankrupt their outlets. And he just doesn't believe that the legislature should, you know, have the authority to make laws. You know, he thinks that federal child labor laws are unconstitutional. He thinks that the ban on whites-only lunch counters is unconstitutional. He thinks that the minimum wage is unconstitutional. You know, this is simply a man who does not believe in democracy. And so I'm not at all surprised to learn that he is married to a woman who apparently also does not have a very strong attachment to democracy.
And finally, Ian Millhiser, the report that Ginni Thomas was at the January 6th protest, the significance of that, and also in these texts calling for the hiring of Sidney Powell, the conspiracy theorist lawyer who even herself in court defended herself by saying no one should have believed what I said.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the fact that she was recommending potential legal counsel certainly suggests that she may have played a larger role. You know, again, we need to see more information. I want to know what's in the new documents. You know, I think that the committee should try to interview Ginni Thomas. You know, there are many people who attended the rally on the Capitol grass, which is lawful. You're allowed to rally on the Capitol grass, and did not invade the Capitol. So we don't, you know, we don't yet know that she committed that particular crime. But again, what we need here is we need more information. We don't know yet if Ginni Thomas has done anything criminal. We don't even know whether she was involved in any of the planning. What we do know so far is that, you know, this wife of a Supreme Court justice was a cheerleader of this coup attempt.
Ian Millhiser, we want to thank you for being with us, senior correspondent at Vox. We will link to your coverage at democracynow.org. Coming up, we're going to look at a new Frontline ProPublica documentary, Plot to Overturn the Election, with reporter A.C. Thompson. Stay with us. Sabotage by Beastie Boys. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A federal judge ruled Monday that former President Donald Trump and his lawyer likely committed multiple felonies in their bid to block certification of Biden's Electoral College victory in 2020. U.S. District Court Judge David Carter ordered Trump legal advisor John Eastman to turn over hundreds of emails to the House committee investigating the January 6th attack after determining Trump and Eastman launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election, calling it a, quote, coup in search of a legal theory, unquote. Also Monday, the House January 6th committee voted unanimously to recommend criminal contempt of Congress charges against former White House aides Peter Navarro and Dan Scavino after they became the latest former Trump administration officials to refuse to cooperate with congressional subpoenas. Meanwhile, as we just reported, the January 6th committee may seek to interview Ginni Thomas, the Republican activist and wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, about her efforts to overturn Donald Trump's 2020 election loss. How these lies about election fraud made their way to the center of American politics are the focus of a new documentary by Frontline and ProPublica premiering tonight on PBS. It's called Plot to Overturn the Election. In a minute, we'll be joined by reporter A.C. Thompson. This is a clip.
An election permeated with fraud. Is that an election? We all know that Biden didn't get 80 million votes. Give me a break.
After months of reporting, I've ended up in Phoenix, Arizona.
We already have a president, and his name is Donald Trump.
It's been more than a year since Donald Trump was defeated.
We will, if I have anything to say about it, decertify the November 2020 presidential election.
If you don't think that fraud exists in the election and you don't think the election was stolen, you're either stupid or you're just not that bright.
But across the country, millions of Americans continue to believe that the election was stolen from him. I'm here to talk to a man who's a big part of the reason why.
We're excited to hear you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for what you're doing.
Thanks for, it's an honor to be able to do it.
Patrick Byrne is a former CEO who spent millions of dollars casting doubt on Joe Biden's election.
When I go up on the stage, it would be a good shot to come up behind me and film that, because the whole crowd does.
Gentlemen, please stand to your feet. Angry Patrick, feel the burn!
He's part of a right-wing movement spreading the idea that the 2020 election was stolen from Trump.
There's overwhelming evidence that it happened in November 20, that the election was rigged, and we're now at the point that
the movement is trying to gain political power and change the way elections are run. I'm here because I want to understand the stolen election myth. Where did it come from? Who's behind it? And how is the ongoing battle over the last election threatening the next one?
We are going to defeat this.
The numbers just came in from North Carolina. This is what we have right now. Too early to call, but our first numbers as the polls close.
Election night, November 3rd, 2020.
170 electoral votes. That's what's required to take the presidency, and we are still early in this night.
I was in Washington covering the activist mobilizing for Trump.
The polls have closed in three more states. Let's take a look. We can't project any of them right now.
Trump had long claimed that the vote would be marred by fraud. As the results rolled in that night, he alleged they were rigged.
This is a fraud on the American public. This is an embarrassment to our country.
USA! 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 USA!
Get out!
In the coming weeks, I was focused on the violence in the streets. I didn't realize that something far more consequential was happening in the hotel suites around me. A plot to undermine and overturn the election.
An excerpt from Plot to Overturn the Election, the new investigative collaboration by Frontline and ProPublica that premieres tonight on PBS. For more, we're joined by A.C. Thompson, the PBS Frontline correspondent on the piece, ProPublica reporter who's long covered the rise of right-wing extremist and white supremacist groups. Thanks so much for being back on with us, A.C. If you can talk about the premise of what you're looking at here in your latest documentary.
So, you know, obviously the person that many of the stolen election theories go back to is Donald Trump. He is sort of the patient zero, the originator. But there are small groups of people that were all around him that built sort of the mythology around it, the narratives around it that put meat on the bones. And we look at one of those groups that was really instrumental in sort of taking Trump's idea and building it into something that had life, that went beyond a single sentence. There was fraud, there was vote rigging. And that group consisted of people including former General Michael Flynn, the disgraced former National Security Advisor. It included Patrick Byrne, the former CEO of Overstock.com. It included Lynn Wood and Sidney Powell, the attorneys, and a small company out of Texas called Allied Security Operations Group. Many of these people are former military. Many of these people have a background in business. And people like Byrne funded this operation to sort of develop a narrative that could sway the courts and could sway the public.
And AC, you talk about a gathering that occurred at a plantation in South Carolina. Could you say a little bit more about that? What was this plantation? Who owned it? Who attended?
Right. So a lot of this activity comes out of a plantation in rural South Carolina owned by conservative attorney Lynn Wood, who was one of the attorneys involved in some of the lawsuits filed to overturn the election. And there was a group of cyber experts, of other litigators, of military folks that converged on the plantation in the last weeks of November and the early December. And basically, they networked with folks all across the country to sort of gather information, collate it, and go out and execute a strategy. And their strategy was, we're going to litigate, we're going to persuade the public, and we're going to get access to voting machines and see what's in there and prove the fraud.
See, let's go to the clip that lays this whole thing out, as you do in Plot to Overturn the Election.
I reach out to my colleague, Doug Bach Clark, who's part of a team of ProPublica reporters investigating election fraud claims. He tells me that to really understand the Antrim report, it helps to look at what happened a few weeks after the election. That's when a group of Trump supporters gathered at this plantation in South Carolina, owned by a lawyer named Lynn Wood.
You and I had a phone call and you said, hey, I'm looking at stuff that happened on Lynn Wood's plantation and what was going on there.
Yes. So after the November 3rd election, many of these people were convinced there's no way Trump could lose. There has to have been fraud. And so they started a process of trying to prove it. What Lynn Wood's plantation became was sort of a headquarters in which a lot of them gathered, synthesized a lot of the information that was pouring across the nation, and then decided how to act on it. And at this point, Mike Flynn has come in to Lynn Wood's plantation.
Among the people who were there was General Michael Flynn, Trump's former national security advisor, who had resigned and pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI. Documents Doug obtained show that Flynn worked with a small team of lawyers and cybersecurity people at the plantation, and that President Trump spoke on the phone to lawyers there at least once. Some of the people there had been coordinating remotely with ASOG, the Dallas firm that wrote the Antrim report.
What evidence did you gather to let you know this is what happened at the plantation?
We got a hold of well over 1,000 emails, hundreds of text messages of what was happening on the plantation. It was almost like finding a key to understanding, you know, why much of the country believes that the election was stolen.
Can you walk me through it?
Yeah. This set of papers basically shows a set of emails that show how they crafted one of the lawsuits in order to try and get access to the Dominion machines. On November 17th, Phil Waldron had written, "Gents, this is our best first list for the equipment lists that need to be included on the injunction list." So he's saying, you know, this is what we think the equipment is that we need for the lawsuits we're going to do. It lists the actual things that they feel that they would need to prove the fraud. What are the pieces that we're going to need?
They're talking about voting equipment.
Right, they're talking about voting equipment.
So versions of this end up getting used in lawsuits all over the country.
Mm-hmm. So the next day on 11...
Has anybody ever seen this?
No.
Like...
Doug says that Flynn and the team carried out a multi-part effort to challenge the presidential election results. Lawsuits, public persuasion, and getting their hands on voting machines and opening them up to scrutiny.
On Thanksgiving Day, while many of these people were eating turkey together at Linwood's plantation, Pauls went out to the county clerks in Antrim, Michigan. And they were basically told, tomorrow, there's going to be a group that's coming up, and, you know, you should let this group access to the machines, you know, please let them see it.
Doug tells me that it's not clear who exactly made the calls. But the next day, the private jet arrived in Antrim.
They were hoping to find evidence of a stolen election. And what they found was nothing. What they found was a bunch of computer logs, which they did not know how to read. They produced a long report, which was deeply riddled with errors, which multiple experts would find to be utterly bunk. But this sort of veneer of technical legitimacy that they would bring to this report would mean that it would spread very wide and go viral in certain ways and create a pillar of the election fraud myth.
A.C. Thompson, I wanted to comment on especially the role of Michael Flynn in all of this. And in speaking of this issue of maintaining the idea of fraud, this has continued to this day. I mean, just this week, I received, and I'm sure many other journalists received in their inboxes, reports supposedly peer-reviewed analyses of votes in particular states claiming that there were inconsistencies in the number of votes that clearly demonstrated that there was fraud in the 2020 elections.
Yeah, you know, it's the thing I think that people don't understand, and this was the thing that was most striking to me, is that the stolen election myth is animating the Republican base to this day. Trump has tapped dozens of candidates who are proponents of this myth who are running for election in the midterms, whether it's governor, whether it's secretary of state, whether it's state legislature. And when you go to Trump rallies, when you go to these events, people do not believe that Joe Biden is the legitimate president of this country. They believe that there has been a historic fraud that deprived Trump of his right to rule this country. They believe that democracy has been destroyed. And so we are living in a very perilous time. January 6th did not change the energy around this issue.
I wanted to go to the last clip we have, Republican efforts to overturn Biden's election victory in Arizona. This is the excerpt of Plot to Overturn the Election.
I go see Bill Gates, a member of Maricopa's Board of Supervisors and a lifelong Republican.
What's going on with the vote around?
Gates and his colleagues commissioned the 93-page analysis of the audit.
This audit is a sham. They're sending out misinformation, half-truths, and then that is being seized upon by the president and others to perpetuate the big lie.
Gates and other supervisors opposed the audit from the start. And I've been Republicans in the state Senate threatened to hold them in contempt and arrest them. And protesters erected a guillotine for them in front of the state capitol. Gates even received a voicemail from Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani.
Bill, it's Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's lawyer. If you get a chance, would you please give me a call? I have a few things I'd like to talk over with you. Maybe we can get this thing fixed up. You know, I really think it's a shame that Republicans sort of were both in this kind of situation. And I think there may be a nice way to resolve this for everybody. So give me a call, Bill. I'm on this number anytime. Doesn't matter. Okay? Take care. Bye.
And when he says, we're Republicans in this together, what do you take that to mean?
Well, I think they believe that they can pick off elections officials, Republicans who are concerned about their future political prospects and, you know, work with these folks to overturn an election, which is despicable. I think every elected official in the Republican Party who remains silent is aiding and abetting this. They all know this is wrong. They tell me that, but then they're silent.
And what happens to this country if moving forward nobody has faith in our election?
That's the beginning of the end of this country. When that happens, that's the beginning of the end of this democracy.
That's Bill Gates of the Maricopa County Supervisors from the documentary. As we wrap up, A.C. Thompson, this takes us to Mark Fincham, and this takes us to what the future looks like. He is an Arizona state representative that you talk about who is running for Arizona Secretary of State, the guy who runs the elections.
Yeah, and Mark Fincham is a guy who has been a member of the Oath Keepers, the militia group. He's a guy who suggested that January 6th was an Antifa plot, a false flag. He was present at the rally on January 6th, and he's a guy that spreads just wild, wild, wild conspiracy theories. And it's entirely possible that he will be the next Secretary of State for the state. He wants no voting machines, all paper ballots, one day of voting, and that's it. And it's really a sort of move back to the past, to the pre-technological era.
And A.C. Thompson, what is your sense of the impact of this continuing lie of the stolen election will have in the 2022 midterm elections and even more importantly in the presidential election?
I think it's going to be, we're going to have to gauge this, right? Do the Trump candidates prevail in the midterms? Are they winning the primaries? That's going to give us a real sense of what direction this country's headed. And I think in states like Arizona, we may see a lot of these Trump conspiracy theory candidates win.
Well, we want to thank you very much for being with us. A.C. Thompson, staff reporter with ProPublica, who's covered the rise of right-wing extremist and white supremacist groups for years. He's the correspondent for the PBS for PBS Frontline. The new documentary, Plot to Overturn the Election, premieres tonight on PBS. Coming up next is negotiators from Russia and Ukraine are holding peace talks in Turkey. We go to Ukraine to speak with a reporter at The Guardian who just left the bombed-out city of Kharkiv. Stay with us. Nate Mook tweeted on March 25th, today the Lviv Philharmonic performed for the first time since the invasion with refugees from across Ukraine joining the orchestra. It was streamed online as the concert hall is now a warehouse for medical supplies that go to hospitals, like food, music to nourish the soul. And that's the music break that we just played. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Ukrainian and Russian officials have begun a new round of peace talks in Istanbul, Turkey. The Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan spoke before the negotiations began.
Achieving a ceasefire and peace as soon as possible is to the benefit of everyone. We think we have now entered a period where concrete results need to be attained from talks.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has also called for a humanitarian ceasefire to end the war, which began when Russia invaded Ukraine 34 days ago.
Let's be clear. The solution to this humanitarian tragedy is not humanitarian. It is political. I'm therefore appealing for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire to allow for progress in serious political negotiations aiming at reaching a peace agreement based on the principles of the United Nations Charter.
In a sign of possible progress, Russia's deputy defense minister said today Russia would, quote, fundamentally cut back military operations near Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine. To look more at Russia's war in Ukraine, we're joined by Emma Graham Harrison, international affairs correspondent for The Guardian. She is joining us from Lviv in western Ukraine, recently reporting, though, from Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city, which has been devastated by weeks of Russian attacks. Emma Graham Harrison, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you begin by just taking us to Kharkiv and what you experienced, who you spoke to?
Thanks so much for having me on the show. So, I mean, perhaps we could start with the drive to Kharkiv. You know, as you said, it's the second biggest city in Ukraine. And the road up there is the road you'd expect. You know, it's a huge highway, sort of multiple lanes in either directions. And it's almost completely empty because the city itself has become so dangerous. It's not technically under siege, but we spoke to the governor. And several people from Kharkiv told us they just can't get drivers willing to bring up food and other supplies, or they struggle to because, you know, the bombardment, the attacks on the city are so intensive that people don't want to risk going up there. So you drive up this sort of eerily empty road, and then you go into a city that the Russian troops are focused on the north and the east. So we were driving in from the south, obviously trying not to cross the front lines. And as you go towards the center, you start seeing the impact of this brutal, brutal assault. I mean, obviously, the worst hit city in this country is Mariupol, the port city that has been besieged and horribly devastated. But, you know, Kharkiv is probably among, you know, those that are competing for the horrible sort of title of being the second most bombed. They sort of announced the assault on Kharkiv by sending a missile into City Hall, which has been completely hollowed out. Firemen are trying to sort of clear the wreckage, make what's left of the building safe. And they've already pulled 30 bodies from the wreckage. And you know, they fear that there are many more people there. And as you drive through town, you see pictures, which for people who've sort of seen images, particularly for Brits who you know, have seen images of the Blitz in World War II, it's reminiscent of that because there'll be a whole house just missing, sort of punched out by a bomb, or, you know, half an apartment building just shorn off, the apartment building open to the sky. And that's just in the center. As you go towards the outskirts where the fighting is most intense, there's hardly a building that hasn't been damaged by shelling. The shells are landing all the time. I mean, we were in a residential neighborhood where people are still living, where there's a metro station. A lot of people who don't have bomb shelters or whose houses have been destroyed have moved into the metro. Somewhat ironically built by in the Soviet era to protect from Western attacks, you know, in the potential Cold War era, now sheltering the people from attacks from Moscow. And just a couple of hours after we left this entirely residential neighborhood, a rocket slammed into a queue of people waiting for food aid. And you can see we went past a school that had been hit. Every building had either, you know, damage, windows missing. But incredibly, there are still people living there, and perhaps half, two-thirds of the city's population have left. But the people we spoke to, some of them couldn't leave, but many of them said they wanted to stay, that there is a military fight on the front lines, and that they are staying for a sort of a different kind of fight, a fight to keep the spirit of their city alive. So we spoke to the governor, we spoke to a poet who's doing poetry readings. Kharkiv is famous for its sort of literary, cultural, intellectual tradition. And he sees himself in a long line of intellectuals, Ukrainian intellectuals based in Kharkiv, who paid a very heavy price for their intellectual opposition to Moscow. You know, in the Soviet era, poets, writers who tried to define a Ukrainian identity and were purged, many of them executed. And you know, he sees being there as a poet, continuing that resistance as part of the struggle. We spoke to volunteers, a young couple who'd gone to the railway station. They were planning to leave at the start of the war. They saw this huge crowd of people. They looked at all these kids trying to get out, and they said, "We're young. Other people need to go more than us." And every day since then, they've been collecting donations just from sort of Instagram, going online. Whatever money they get, they go to a supermarket, they package up small food supplies. They don't have that much money, you know, some pasta, some cans. And then they go to the worst hit neighborhoods where people don't have money because, of course, the economy stopped with the war. People are running out of things to eat. In some cases, they're housebound. They can't get out to what shops are still open. And they're handing out this food. And I mean, we saw people running when the van turned up with these parcels, people literally running to get the food. And they said that neighborhood was not even the worst hit, that they've been to other parts of Kharkiv where people were fighting for the food because the situation has got so bad. But they are part of this strong community that are determined to stay. We went out with the rubbish collector. You'd think, you know, city under heavy shelling, they've been given flak jackets, so they're going out with, you know, body armor protection. But they say, you know, we've got to collect the rubbish because actually if you leave it there, it becomes a hygiene issue. If there's a lot of rubbish that's not collected, it's a morale issue. If there's piles of sort of stinking trash, people will feel that their city's been abandoned. And so we have to go and keep this spirit of our city alive while our soldiers are sort of fighting for it on the front line, which is only a few kilometers away.
And Emma Graham, you write that there's a sense that Kharkiv is being punished by Russia for its resilience, its resistance, because it's managed to hold off Russian troops. Could you expand on that?
Certainly. So, I mean, a lot of people that we spoke to there said this to us. I mean, they said, look, you know, for instance, in this very residential neighborhood where the guys were collecting rubbish, it was just apartment blocks, schools, a couple of little shops, every building pretty much was damaged, including the school. And they said, you know, look around you. What is the military target here? That was very near where this queue of people waiting for humanitarian aid were hit and six people were killed. You know, they said, what possible military target is there here? You know, the city hall, the fact that that was, you know, targeted with a missile. The other places we saw that were, you know, many were just individual residents, but, you know, a courtroom, a famous place actually called House of the Word, this sort of literary heritage place, you know, none of them in any way military targets. And, you know, Kharkiv is a Russian-speaking city. It's just by the Russian border. Russian troops, it was targeted right at the beginning of the war. The governor of Kharkiv region told us that Russian forces got into the city but were repelled. And the captives that they'd spoken to, the Russian prisoners of war, said they had been told and they expected, particularly because this is seen as a sort of, you know, it was actually a capital of Ukraine. In some ways, it's seen as a sort of cultural, intellectual capital of Russian-speaking Ukraine. They expected to be welcomed there, expected to be let in. And that because there'd been this military success, because the Russian army was not able to punch into Kharkiv, was not able to take it, that there was this sort of pent-up fury that the Russian military was unleashing on them, pummeling these civilian neighborhoods. You know, as we've seen, for instance, in Mariupol, you know, neighborhoods that are just homes, where there is no military reason to be hitting these places, you know, to be hitting apartment blocks, to be hitting schools.
Emma, I wanted to go to some Kharkiv residents clearing rubble and debris after a school was hit by a missile. They told Reuters Russia had intentionally targeted the civilian structure. One man said he wanted to send a message to his brother in Russia, who doesn't believe reports that Russia is hitting civilian targets.
This is a civilian structure. It is a school. They have not been able to take the city, so they decided to destroy it, just like the fascists did, simply fascists. But what the Russians do now, let them choke on their own body parts. Not even the fascists did things like this. This is very cruel. It is pointless. It doesn't make any sense. What has the school done wrong? What have the children done wrong? What have I done wrong?
I looked out of the window. People started panicking, so I came to help my former school. The Russians say they only attack military objects and structures. This is not true. Look here. This is what is really happening. Let everyone see. Let no one say it is fake news.
I want to send greetings to my brother in Severodvinsk. Here, look, brother, you have liberated your niece, surely a Nazi. As you can see, we are all Nazis. So you have liberated your niece, the Nazi, from her school. Earlier, you have liberated your nephew, also a Nazi, from another school. The missile landed right in his classroom.
Those are the words of Kharkiv residents. Emigram Harrison, this started with a man trying to address his brother in Russia who didn't believe the propaganda about what was happening in Ukraine. And I wanted to go to something you tweeted, a petition by journalists calling on Zelensky and MOD, that's the Minister of Defense, to end harassment and develop transparent rules of work. Of course, it decries Russia's attack on independent media. But then it goes to the Ukrainian government, and it raises all sorts of issues, like settling the issue of accreditation of journalists from the Ministry of Defense, explaining to the territorial defense units and the security services of Ukraine on the ground that this accreditation means, also providing all possible assistance to the work of Ukrainian journalists on a par with foreign media. Can you talk about, and signed by dozens of reporters?
I was not involved in drawing that up. I was really trying to use my platform to amplify the voices of Ukrainian journalists. I think it's really important that their work on the forefront of reporting this conflict in their own country is recognized. So I think probably I'm not the best person to speak about the petition, just in the sense that I wasn't involved in drawing it up. But certainly, always in conflict zones it's important to make sure that that everybody understands and recognizes the work of journalists, and that there's a clear accreditation system, so it's easy for us to prove who we are, that we're genuine journalists, and that we're doing our job.
And I wanted to ask you, last night on PBS was one of the few interviews that's been held with a spokesman for Russia's President Putin about Russia's role in the war. And Judy Woodruff asked the spokesman about this issue of the targeting of cities. He denied it. He claimed that, and we've heard this before in other wars, including the United States, that the Ukrainian soldiers were using civilian facilities for sniper attacks and for other attacks on Russian troops. Any evidence of that you saw? What was the role of the Ukrainian military in the period that you were there in Kharkiv?
So I can say in the civilian neighborhoods where I personally was and where I witnessed, as I said, very extensive deaths from shelling, where there was a death, or six deaths, particularly in one neighborhood, I didn't see any military presence at all of any kind. I mean, there were checkpoints in the city at sort of key junctions and things like that. So clearly there was a military presence in the city. But certainly in the areas that I visited where I saw, damage and destruction. And I'd like to say at this point, I also went to visit the hospital in Kharkiv, or one of the many hospitals where, of course, as we've seen, there's been dozens of attacks on healthcare facilities across Ukraine in this war. Perhaps most infamously the bombing of the maternity hospital in Mariupol, but doctors in hospitals are extremely frightened of being targeted because they're, or at least of being hit. Of course, Russia says they're not being targeted, but they're certainly being hit. Many of them didn't want to give interviews. They said they were torn between the desire to show the world what was happening to the civilians that they're treating, and their fear that talking about it publicly might put their patients at risk by making them a profile. And that's a really terrible, terrible thing to hear, And the hospital we went to, there was shelling very close. The doctors and nurses had moved in at the beginning of the war and not left because of the intensity of the fighting and because of the curfew in the city. They were living there around the clock to treat their patients. They said, if we go home and it's curfew and there's a big attack and a lot of patients come in, who's going to look after them? And the people we met there were the people who'd been affected by the shelling, by the war, were certainly civilians. For instance, an 18-year-old girl who was at home when their building, actually the building next door to them, was hit by something very large, so it affected their building. She refused to leave her apartment because her 93-year-old, I believe, grandfather, certainly a very elderly grandfather, was a double amputee. He couldn't easily get down to the basement bomb shelter. You know, I think, you know, everybody can understand that very human desire to be with your loved ones, not to leave them alone. And when the force of the explosion hit it, it picked up a door, it tore it off its hinges, and it slammed it into her
face.
We have
5 seconds. Emma, we want to thank you for being with us. Emma Graham Harrison works for The Guardian. We'll link to her recent coverage from Kharkiv. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
I drive my bus in a busy city. That's why road safety is so important to me. I know that I must slow down and be extra careful when I make a wide turn. Buses need more room than cars. Everyone can help keep our roads safe. Next time you're driving, remember to give buses plenty of time and space to finish turning before driving ahead. Let's all plan to share the road safely. Learn how at www.sharetheroadsafely.gov.
Hey, I'm Mando Richard from WRCT's Wednesday Folk Show, Whiskey Before Breakfast. On Friday, December 31st at 11 p.m., Pittsburgh musician Art Lindsay will join me for WRCT's third annual Hank Williams tribute. We like to remember Hank Williams on New Year's because in the wee hours of the morning on January 1st, 1953, Hank Williams passed away in the back of an automobile from way too much whiskey, quote, vitamins, unquote, and drugs consumed before, during, and after breakfast. Art and I will sample some of the thousands of recordings Hank made in a national career that spanned just 6 years, and this year we'll also explore a little bit of Hank Williams' legacy. So turn down the sound on whatever tripes on the tube and tune in to WRCT's annual Hank Williams Tribute, Friday, December 31st at 11 p.m. at 88.3 FM, Pittsburgh, or streaming from WRCT.org.
It's the Viva La Mock radio program. Before we get into the Midnight Mock, I do want to remind you that Attic Records joins you in supporting WRCT. Attic Records is what? It's a record store. And where's it located? Millvale. It's open 7 days a week, and it provides new and used records and CDs. From metal to reggae, hip-hop to doo-wop, and all stops in between, Attic Records has the hottest new releases and all the music that you want. Family-owned and operated, Attic Records pays for quality used records and CDs. With no collection too big, no collection too small, you can visit Attic Records today in Millvale or just call them up at 412-821-8484 and get the music you need. We have a Bats Mock to get into, so let me put some Bats music in the background. I was going to say Bats ground, but it didn't work. I was going to try, at least. The Bats, just so you are aware, a four-piece out of New Zealand, formed back in 1982. What's great is they've gone on hiatus and come back like a lot of bands do, but still with the same four original members. That's Malcolm Grant on drums, Paul Kane on bass, Kay Woodward on lead guitar and rhythm guitar and vocals, Robert Scott, who was also post-Bats, had the band The Clean, which I played earlier. So I'm like, let's do a Bats mock tonight. That's what we're going to do. So we are starting off said Bats mock with the singer-songwriter Barbara Manning here on the Viva La radio program.